Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is broadcaster, curator, critic, Jerry Broughton. He's a professor of English and history at the University of London, and we're talking about his new book, 4 Points of the Compass, The Unexpected History of Direction. Jerry, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. It's really, really great to be with you, Mark.
I just want to say on your behalf, the kinds of books I love, and I have to read 2 to 4 books a week for this show, and I read them thoroughly. People who've been on the show before know that. I read them beginning to end and underline in the whole thing. The kind of book I really love is the book that I think I know where the book is going to go before I start, and then it goes in a totally different direction.
Yeah, literally.
No pun intended. And this is 4 Points of the Compass is one of those books. You know, I thought it was all going to be about, you know, the discovery of the compass and the perfection of this and that. And that certainly is in this book, but it's not the meat and potatoes of the book. And we'll talk about what this book is really about. But I want to mention that from the get-go, this book surprised me. You start with the famous photo of the blue marble, the picture of the Earth taken from space.
I do, and I mean, it's such a powerful image, and I'm sure many people...
I lived through this, and I didn't know what I'd been seeing a wrong image.
They flipped the image. So it's an amazing story that I discovered that when NASA launched the mission, they put a camera in with the kit for the astronauts, and they rather wonderfully, I mean, I'm saying this slightly tongue-in-cheek. They said, take some pictures while you're up there, which is such a lovely idea. Hey, while you're up there, you know, take some pictures. And we don't know which one of the three astronauts took this most extraordinary...
Well, you wrote that they all took credit?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just hilarious. You know, nobody knows who took it. And those logs are so precise. So it's a wonderful mystery. They took the picture, they beamed it back to NASA, and NASA looked at it, and they said, it's upside down. So they'd taken the picture, and of course the Earth was rotating. And you see south at the top. So you see the Cape of Good Hope. You see Madagascar at the top. And they went, people wouldn't get it. So they flipped it. And I just think this is the most reproduced photo in the world. And it's wrong.
And this gets the heart of the matter of your book. We take it for granted that there's an actual north, south, east, and west. And it's not that simple at all. And not only that, which way up is true? I mean, and you know, they've never really made it widely public constantly that image has been flipped. But I immediately went, geez, that would have been such a teaching moment to tell people what was going on.
Exactly. And one of the other maps in the book is an Australian map, MacArthur's map from the 1970s, where a similar issue happens.
That's right.
He's a school kid. He's in Australia. He's asked to draw the world. He does it, and he puts south at the top, and his teacher says, no, you've done it wrong, Stuart. And he's so enraged, he produces a map, which then gets quite a lot of traction in the late 70s and 80s, called his universal corrective map, and he puts south at the top, and he says, long live Australia. And, you know, we're laughing, and of course it's very funny, but it underscores a sort of extraordinary fact that there is no reason for north to be at the top. And certainly geomagneticism means that, you know, yes, we are hardwired to an idea of north and south on a compass. But what the book, and it's interesting what you said at the start, because the book is not really just about a history of science and the history of the compass, because the book really is about how directions, thousands of years before the invention of the compass, it totally is predated by winds. We think about direction in terms of winds. So the notion that we're hardwired with north and south is absolutely not the case. In fact, probably the first prime axis in terms of directions is east and west.
Right.
Because for ancient societies, the sun rises in that part of the world, and that therefore becomes known as the East, and it sets in the West. And the East is therefore a place of, you know, birth, of light, and the West is a place of darkness and disappearance. That's the first axis, and then North-South comes later. But there's no reason for North to be at the top. South works just as well.
But your book goes so much far beyond that, because it ends up that the way we think about these directions affects the way we think about people other than in our culture. It has been the cause of racism. It's been the cause of imperialism. I mean, there's so much baggage that goes with are hardwired for these directions.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that interested me, because in the UK, I'm from the north, and therefore I get called a northerner, and certain attributes are ascribed to that, and you have it here in the US, as you know, in terms of, it's interesting, it's often more east and west coast, although there's the idea of you know, the south and being a southerner. Now, if you're in Italy, it works in a different way to it does in the UK, because in the UK, I'm seen as a northerner, and that has suggestions that I'm probably not very clever, that I'm poor, I probably carry whippets with me, and I drink warm beer. It's a myth, but we all play the game, you know, and I do this when I give talks. I say to people, how do you identify you're a northerner or a southerner? In England, many people hardly at all identify as an easterner. But as you were just saying, Mark, we talk about the idea of the Orient and Orientalism.
Right.
There's a whole imperial tradition to how the West, and now you can start to see how this game gets so complicated. The West creates an idea of the East, which it calls the Orient, and that word is from the Latin, Oriens, which means the sun rising. So even when we talk about orientation, that means the East. So literally the word orientation, you know, is about the rising of the sun in the east. And to say we are disoriented means we have lost our direction according to the east. So these words, these terms go so deep, and they go deep not only into how we understand the world and direction and orientation, but also how we think of ourselves, northerners, southerners. There's no such place. I had such fun in the book with debates and arguments about the Middle East. What is the Middle East?
God, what a mess.
Exactly. No wonder it's a mess, because nobody can define what it is.
Oh, God.
It presupposes the idea that we are, that your kind of imaginative geography is centered kind of on Europe and the Atlantic, Europe, North America, and therefore there is such a place as the Middle East and then the Far East. But of course, it is a myth, but it's a very powerful myth.
Well, people still use those terms.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And they're meaningless.
They're completely meaningless, and they shift so quickly. The great story I tell at the end of the book is I used to live in East Berlin just after the wall.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, of course, a city that was divided according to East and West, but that was a completely artificial construction. Such a wonderful story. A friend who was an artist, and he said that while the wall was still up, he would listen to West Berlin radio, and he bought an old map of the city before it was divided. So he'd listen to the radio, and he'd have his map spread out. So he knew the entire map in his brain of a city that he thought he'd never see, or half of it. After the wall came down, he told me this. I mean, it just made me cry. I remember it was such a poignant story. He said he went over the wall, and he was running around with everybody, and a West Berlin came up to him and in German said, "Oh, excuse me, where's such and such a street?" And he said, "Oh, it's four blocks down there. Take a right, and it's on your left." And that map was embedded in his mind of West Berlin. And he said to me, it was so powerful, Mark. He said to me, at that moment, I was no longer an Aussie, an East Berliner.
Right.
He said, I was no longer an Aussie. I was just a Berliner. And I thought, wow, what an amazing story again about direction that suddenly flips. It changes. And everything changes. And so those directions, meaningless. Although we work with them, you know, obviously they are meaningful in some ways, which is part of what I was saying in the book.
But it's interesting, you know, take in America, the Civil War has always developed, sort of made us into a North or a South.
Yeah.
Even though there were states that were involved in one way or the other that were to the West. It's amazing, and you still think, I mean, it's still ingrained in people's minds to think about the South in a certain way.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And then again, it flips very quickly, because then that same imagination will think about East and West and westwards, because you're obviously right, and I'm not going to tell you anything about American history, but the manifest destiny argument.
Go West, young man.
Always going West, go West, young man, you know, which of course, again, the ambiguity even of the invention of that term, that it both means keep going West, keep discovering, but of course it also means to die. And
that's right.
So fascinating about this idea of the West. The West is this, you know, the great little thing that some of your listeners will probably know, that lovely puzzle. How is it that if you start going north, eventually you'll start going south. But if you go west, you'll never start going east. Think about it. And of course it is. It's because it's a man-made creation of the idea of a North and South Pole. And we'll get on to that. But, you know, there is no such thing as the North or South Pole.
Nope.
You know, this hilarious idea, you know, that you create the notion from the Greeks that you have an enormous, vast, universal pole running through the center of the universe, and the Earth is at the center. That's why we talk about the north-south poles. But there is no such thing as definable north pole and south pole. They move. There's geographic north and there's magnetic north, as some of your listeners.
And magnetic north moves all the time.
And it moves all the time. So even when Peary, as it were, is the first man to, you know, reach the North Pole, he's working out, you know, in terms of mathematical calculations, where he thinks that position is. But it's movable. And anyway, he doesn't, because Matthew Henson gets there, so it's an African-American who first gets to the North Pole.
I know.
I mean, the stories just, you know, go on and on and on about the hilarity. And even Henson is unsure whether, you know, he plants the flag and he goes, I made it, you know, I'm the first dude to reach the North Pole, and he's a black guy. But then where is there? There's a great bit, you know, where people say this. There is no here to here, because it's movable. It's the same with the South Pole. And East and West, of course, have no fixed position like that. So they just, you go round and round and round and round.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is broadcaster, curator, critic, Jerry Broughton. He's a professor of English and history at the University of London. And we're talking about his new book. It's a really interesting read. 4 Points of the Compass, The Unexpected History of Direction. Jerry, was it always 4 cardinal directions? And again, as you bring up in the book, as you write, you know, these things are usually decided by winds or ideas about spirits or people that lived in certain directions. But was it always 4?
It's a really good question, because different cultures have different numbers of directions. So we then talk about the intercardinal directions. So you can have, many sailors will be listening, you have the 4 directions, but so then you can have 8, and then you have 16 and 32, and you have compass roses, which can be 64 and even up to 128. Most cultures tend to use those 4 directions, but not all, because the Aztecs have 5 directions. So if you look at the Mesoamerican, those amazing pre-Columbian Aztec codex that we have in places like the Met and the British Museum, they show, yes, 4 directions, and they're oriented with east at the top, and we'll talk about that. But they have a center, the quincunx, which is effectively you.
Right.
So there's a 5th direction, and that's kind of, I think, fascinating, because we are now, I think, going back to that tradition because of the way in which we use our phones. We are the blue dot. We are the 5th direction. But historically, there tends to be a focus on the idea that there are 4 rough directions, because the sun rises, we call that east, it sets, it's west. At midday, and that's why I think the north-south axis comes later, at midday we can see that the sun is directly overhead, and that's north and therefore south. So you have these 2 axes, and once you have that, from then you can start to build different directions. But it's often about wind as well. So the earliest maps that we have, which will seem to be roughly look like maps, which are Mesopotamian maps, are showing estates where they have actually on stone maps, so carved onto the stone, you have a sort of estate, you're trying to work out, you know, crops and so on. And those are given directions, which are actually not quite north, south, east, west, they're sort of northeast, northwest.
Wow.
And they're usually from angles of winds. So, of course, you need winds, because in a primarily agrarian society, you need to know where the north wind is going to come, because it might flatten your crops. And the south winds often are ones which bring warming winds, and therefore that's a good sign, and you're going to get ripening of crops. So it's often more meteorological. The Greeks do the same thing. So Aristotle talks, he writes a whole book, you know, basically the meteorology. It's about the weather, but it's actually, again, about directions. And it's really Aristotle who then starts to say, you have all these intercardinal directions. So most cultures use 4, but not always. And some cultures even don't use direction at all. Some indigenous American cultures, it's fascinating to look at how they understand direction. Because right back through prehistory, it's often about your body and your body in relation to the world around you. So you understand up and down, and they're often synonyms in many languages, up and down, north, south,
right
to left, east to west. So some African cultures, again, in Mali, they use these extraordinary little images, rock art images, where they have the idea of the life of the world, the Aduna Kine. It's in Dogon rock art. So the head is north, the legs are south, the left arm is east, and the right arm is west. And that works right through monotheistic cultures as well, front and back. So in Hebrew, east also means front or forward, and west means behind. In Arabic, you know, it's flipped again, so north is al-shamal, which is left, south is al-janub, or to the right. So you can go on. I mean, the language stories are kind of brilliant about how things develop in this way around direction. And this is way, way before the Chinese invent the compass.
Oh, yeah.
3,000 years ago.
It's even to the point where if I was to ask a person somewhere on the planet to name the four directions, they may name them in a different order. Like, I always go north, south, east, west.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the book deliberately is a provocation.
I know that.
Turn away from that. Yeah. So we start in the east with the idea you follow the day, really. So you go from east and then you end in the west. But the Chinese will do that in a different direction. So it's not clockwise. So we think, again, we're hardwired. So we say northeast, southwest. Look, it follows a clock, right? It's going north, east, south, west. The Chinese would flip that because their compasses point south, and that is literally the literal word for a Chinese compass means the thing that points south. That's the Chinese word for compass. So they will do that in a different way. So you can scramble your orientation. It's really fascinating because different societies will start with a different cardinal direction. And even that word, you know, with east at the top, even the word comes from the Latin, which means hinge. That's why we have cardinals. The idea is that they're a hinge in the church between, you know, God and the congregation. So that's where we get the word. Again, it's relatively, in my scale of history, relatively recent to use that term. So different cultures and societies will orientate themselves with a prime cardinal direction, which will be different. Some will be east, some will use south, some will use north. Not many use west.
That's interesting.
West, because west is where the sun sets.
It's the end of things.
It's the end of things. And it's such an amazing thing about the west, you know, because we talk about, again, if I say travel to Japan, I would say I am a westerner. If I'm back in the UK, I'll say I'm a northerner. I don't know what I say now. I'm here in New York wonderfully. It's a funny one because it's all situational. It just depends where you stand on the globe. But the West is this amazing story because West is often seen as a place of, yes, death and disappearance, but also of rebirth, regeneration. So it's Elysium. It's the site of Atlantis. And so when the Europeans start going westwards, I think there is that sense of destiny that you're traveling. It's a dangerous place because you're traveling into the dark sea. You may just disappear or you may reinvent yourself.
I want to talk about north.
Yeah.
Each chapter has so much to get into.
Yeah.
But north is interesting. A lot of cultures characterize it as bleak, cold, and dark.
Yeah.
And I understand that because it is, and living in New England, it is bleak, cold, and dark. But it also has these other significances that you write about, north versus south, modernity and prosperity, or poverty and backwardness.
Yeah.
It has to do with how you speak and behave. And, you know, you write about the southern drawl. But I'm fascinated by the mystical lands of the north, like Hyperborea. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, Hyperborea, so the idea, you know, the ultimate point of north, because it seems to be, again, a place, if you're particularly in the Western Hemisphere, you go north. And so it's a place, perhaps, of disappearance, and it's about ice, and it's about extreme cold, but it's also about some sense of purity. So mythical, you know, Norse legends are about, you know, the north is this place into which you disappear and perhaps you can return and are you regenerated? And so many writers do this, you know, C.S. Lewis talking
right.
about the idea of the north. Philip Pullman, I mean, anybody who's read Philip Pullman, who is in that tradition, of course, of people like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, and Pullman's, you know, whole concept, you know, in his saga is about the North as a place where you go, and it's a place of deep danger, but it's also a place of regeneration and where you can find yourself again. Frankenstein, you know.
I know. That's how it ends. It ends in the North.
It ends in the North, and it's this idea, you know, of the monster, and you're floating away, you know, in this scene of the northern, you know, wastelands. So the Arctic is this point of absolute extremity. Has always been this place where you push your limits and where things can change radically. It's really interesting around artists in terms of black artists, or people like Isaac Julian doing amazing work about, you know, the North and the Arctic, because of course its associations are with extreme whiteness.
That's right.
I interviewed a black British adventurer, Dwayne Fields, the first black English guy who got to the North Pole, and he said, you know, I did it because, you know, there is a sort of implicit racism that, you know, black kids aren't supposed to like the cold and go up here. And it was sort of fascinating to sort of think about the way in which you reimagine that idea of the North. And now, of course, with what's happening with the ice caps melting, it starts to look different again. So the idea that you can travel into that furthest point and you won't just die and freeze to death, you can, as it were, go over the top. And there's something really, I think, powerful about the idea that the North is at the top of the world. And you see a lot of map makers with their dividers sit on a globe at the top of the North. And it's almost as though that's where you go into the mind. You know, the North.
Well, you write about Basho, who took a journey ever northward in Japan. And what it was an interior journey of his mind.
Yeah, so the Japanese tradition, again, of the North as a place of, you know, superstition and sort of, you know, magical creatures. But it is a place where you go to test your absolute limits, and you are probably purified and reborn in some way. So it's got a kind of long tradition, it absolutely, in contrast, as you were saying, as you started with the South. What's really interesting is the way in which all the directions are defined by their opposite. So you can only really understand East by thinking about West, because you have to have a contrast to understand it. North and South are similar. So this idea of the North, which is somehow magical, it's, you know, I think it's one of the ways in which we're so fascinated, you know, by those North myths and the Vikings. They come from somewhere up there. And we talk up. There's no such thing as up. But again, we think about the North as somehow being up, and South is therefore down and associated, as you were saying, the drawl, you know, the heat.
Laziness.
Sensuality. Absolutely laziness. You know, Susan Sontag, I start the South chapter with this great piece, you know, where Sontag says, you know, once the Southerners get you, you know, that's it. You start dancing and you're sort of sensual and drinking, and that's part of that whole myth again about the South. But again, it depends where you are. You know, in the South, in England, actually people aren't seen like that in any way. They're seen as industrious, you know, clever, you know, urbanized, well-developed, highly educated. Actually, in England, our North is a bit like your idea of the South or the Italians' idea of the South. So again, it all depends.
Yeah, but North England produced Joy Division.
Are you? We're going to talk about. I mean, I love Joy Division. I mean,
We'll have to talk off mic, because I'm also a rock DJ, and I'm a huge fan of New Order and Joy Division.
Oh my goodness! This conversation now will take a whole completely different turn. New Order. It was the first gig I ever saw. I mean,
don't go there, because we're going to go off the rails right there.
But you're right. You know, and when that whole tradition of that music, you know, it was very.
Yeah, think about Joy Division as the Northern sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's we're gonna run out of time, but I gotta mention Mercator's idea about what happens when you go north. You write about Mercator, the guy who did this celebrated 2D projection of the world.
Yeah,
but he had some weird ideas about what happens when you go north.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very, very funny story. So Mercator is a Flemish map maker, you know, from what we now call Belgium. He knows there's a problem, because the Earth is a sphere. So if you have a two-dimensional map and you draw a line across it, any of your listeners who are sailors know that you draw a straight line. But actually, of course, it's on a globe. You're going traveling across the globe, so it'd be curved. So Mercator's like, how do you work out a flat map of the world that can correct that distortion so that the line you draw if you're going from, say, London to Cuba is a straight line and you don't need to keep correcting yourself because of curvature. So he creates this map in 1569, and it's his big projection. He says it's for navigating. And what he does, he distorts. So the further north and south you go, the parallels get further and further apart until you get maximal distortion at the north and south pole. Mercator says that doesn't matter because none of us are going to the North or the South Pole. His interest, and still in that 16th century period, is about trade moving
east
to west.
That's right.
So it's post-Columbus and it's the Portuguese going east. So he creates a map which is distorted to infinity at the north. But he puts north at the top, ironically, and north triumphs because nobody needs to go there.
Didn't he also believe if you went far enough north, it was hollow? There was a big hole at the top and you went down in?
Yeah, this is one of the kind of problems.
Okay, we're actually almost out of time, so we can't. I just want to tell the audience that you write about that. But I love the idea that you go so far north that you go in.
You go into a hollow earth, and that's what he believes. It's wild. I mean, and he's the great scientist, and he believes that there's pygmies at the top of the world, and it's an inflowing sea, and the world is actually hollow. And you go, uh-oh. I mean, it's wild. It's an extraordinary.
Yeah, except there are still people who believe the earth is hollow.
Absolutely. It's a very, very...
There are entire novels written about Hollow Earth. And actually, when you think about it, Journey to the Center of the Earth was about Hollow Earth.
Absolutely.
Before we go, I want to mention, you have some amazing maps, color reproduced in black and white in the book. And most of these maps I had never seen before. And they're absolutely wild.
Yeah.
But we are completely out of time. We could talk about the book for hours. My guest tonight is broadcaster, curator, critic, Jerry Broughton. He's a professor of English and history at the University of London, and we've been talking about his book. Trust me, read this book. 4 Points of the Compass, The Unexpected History of Direction. Jerry, it's been a pleasure.
What an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.